Mr. Gay Wan Gui, Rue 20.
They consider themselves pretty lucky. As I said already, it was this constant fear of the Japanese secret police and the Japanese occupation, the Japanese soldiers and so on, and the rationing of the food, the shortage of rice.
How was relationship among the settlers in Enda?
I think it was very good. At least among the educated class. You see, even then we sort of divided ourselves, you know, naturally of course, because the English-speaking group would be among the English-speaking, the Chinese-speaking would be among Chinese-speaking, the Teochew, Hokkien, and Mandarin-speaking among the Mandarin-speaking, you see. And Chinese got various dialects, and we among the English-speaking group, we had the teachers and the lecturers and so on. We played chess and we were very friendly. And if we, especially myself, we were quite often short of rice. Sometimes we didn't have to cook, although we had rice. The wives of these people would come and say, "Don't forget, you know, you will meet me when I come back from my paddy field. Don't forget to tell your wife to come tomorrow and get some food. We have some left over." So I would inform my wife, who would be on her way home after selling some shirts or sarong. She was doing some business of her own on commission by asking people whether they had shirts or any clothing for sale. And she would bring them to the Malay kampongs, villages inside the paddy fields, among the paddy field villages to sell. And they would give us food. And so collecting of food among these people here and there and so on might be really adequate for us to carry on, but it was not too good to go around every day to walk miles just to get some food. Sometimes we might get, sometimes we might not, and so on. So they were very cooperative with regard to sharing of foodstuffs and work too. We would help each other, lending of implements and tools. And if we had anything to share that would think that we think others would like to have, we would.
What about relationship between the various, among the various groups? Were there any problems, for instance, between the English speaking and the Chinese speaking?
There were no problems. We would come together, we communicate in a common language, whatever we could use at that moment, we communicated with each other very freely, very easily. You know how Chinese people are in Chinatown. You just communicated, bought and sell and sold, and talked very freely and wished each other, greeted each other. I believe that people in time of adversity together were more helpful and brother-like than at other times. And we forgot all about our snobbishness, our sort of attitudes at other times. We only realized that we wanted all this thing to pass. We wanted back our freedom and our liberty. We wanted our old days to come back.
So you did mix around with those who were non-English speaking?
Yes, we did.
Earlier you mentioned that when you arrived in Endau, there were already other settlers before you. Who were these who went up first?
Well, they were people more or less like us, you know. Maybe a few clerks and or workers and so on, and their families, groups and their families, and a few professional people and their families. We all divided into groups. Those who fight earlier, I suppose, were put in group 1, group 2, group 3, group 4, group 5, and so on.
Were there many new arrivals after your batch?
Yes, every time we went, it was about 400 people, 300 or 400 people. Batch, was it? As I said already, one lorong would be about one batch, about 300 to 400 people.
Do you remember how many batches went up after your batch?
I have no idea. You went up to lorong 10 and I lost touch because I went inside. I stayed in my lorong for some time until I got my house ready. I moved away. And when you moved away, you'd be 2 miles, 1 or 2 miles away from the settlement, and it would be quite difficult to walk out.
Do you have any idea when was the last batch who went up to Endau?
No, I didn't keep track. I have no idea.
Were there any problems or difficulties for these new arrivals to settle down?
In fact, the later arrivals, I mean, they enjoyed more facilities because by the time they arrived, the things were more set and all planned and arranged for them properly, more than we early settlers had. And they were luckier. More things were set up for them. They had fewer problems.
Did they have time to go to their land to farm?
I don't think so, because not long after that the Japanese surrendered. I don't think so.
By that time, were there still a lot of settlers staying in the community hut at the various lorongs?
The huts were always full. If you are not full, the people inside would avail themselves of the empty spaces for putting the things and so on. So they would be filled up again when the new settlers came. They would be cleaned up. The idea was they were all transit places and they were all kept in good condition. The point is, the later settlers knew by that time that was a place that they would stay on a temporary basis. That it was nonsense to go there to settle and farm and be self-sufficient. It was an ideal, and largely propaganda. And obedience to the command of the Supreme Command, Japanese Supreme Commander, which had to be undertaken by Mr. Shinozaki himself. And it was the wish of the people themselves to go up. That was about all. So if anybody could have sufficient money and the determination or desire to stand for a year or so, you could judge for yourself that the war would not last long. Just escape from the clutches. Because by that time the B-52s were coming already, the 4-engine bombers, we see them flying, across Johor Bahru right to Singapore. And in case of second invasion, Singapore might be bombed. So many people were thinking, that's a good place to escape to. So they use it as an excuse. So the later settlers were actually not the intention was actually not the same as early onset.
So were they allowed to stay in the community huts without moving to their land and building their own houses?
No, they were, the same procedure would be taken for them. The same process. Whether they would could clear the land early or not is up to them, as long as they could feed themselves and fend for themselves. As long as they didn't complain and didn't bother. As long as they could live on the rations given to them. That's about all.
What were the background of these later batches, the people from these later batches?
I suppose about the same. Because by that time I didn't mix very much. I was more absorbed with my own farm.
Did you have any idea how they, what were they doing if they were not, these new people, what were they doing if they were not farming on their land? What kind of activities would they be engaging in?
Well, they might be playing mahjong at night. They might be playing chess or draughts or amusing themselves, with all sorts of things. That's what I imagine they would do. And they would be going to the restaurant to gorge themselves with delicacies, because the restaurant was always full. We have heard of the iguana soup and fork soup, the kind of thing. The restaurant over there was famous for its fine food, Bin Chun Yin, very good. And even at that time, you could get roast pig. Where could you get roast pig? You could eat roast pig at that restaurant at that time. And fresh fish, you could get any amount. Lovely fresh fish. And these people had money. If they had no money, how could a restaurant of that standard flourish there? They're not cheap, My sister-in-law worked as a waitress there, one of my sisters-in-law. And I, during my spare time, my wife and I would go and cut wood to sell them. So we did earn something from them as well.
What would these people do for a living? Or where would they get their supply of food, like vegetables and all that?
Money. They brought the money along with them, They had plenty of money. Or if you had any jewelry or anything which you could barter and exchange for money anytime, you could sell one shirt for $500, $1,000.
So you would say that this later groups of people, they did not really engage in farming or other economic activities?
No. They didn't have to.
How did they relate with the older settlers?
With the old settlers? Well, they're all right. As I said, the Chinese, they mix very well. All right, you're wealthy, you have the money. We are the older settlers. We grow things you want, we sell to you. You buy, you pay, give us the money. And some other, there is an exchange. Our products, our produce, we exchange for your money. And let's all go to the restaurant to enjoy ourselves and have a good feed of pao or siu mai or something like that.
By the time you left Andao, how many settlers were in Andao?
By the time I left, I was one of the first to leave actually, about half left. I was lucky to be able to leave because lorries and so on were very hard to get. We had to spend quite a lot of money. It was very lucky I could share it with a friend, a teacher friend, a colleague actually.
At the time of the Japanese surrender, how many settlers were in Andao?
I have no idea. It should be around about 7,000, 8,000. I have no idea. Around about that, When we went back, we did not think bring many things, only our clothes and ourselves and our rice, and that's about all. Because the Lord had no space.
So all in all, the settlement had about 7,000 to 8,000.
I don't know, maybe more actually, or less.
Do you remember when you were there, whether there were any cases of forced or compulsory labor for Japanese? Did the Japanese authorities ever ask for workers to work for their projects?
No. That's one thing. We were all free to do. They kept to their word. Did not interfere with us.
Besides the killings by the anti-Japanese people and the difficulties encountered in farming, were there any other difficulties or hazards encountered by the settlers and yourself in Andong?
No, there were no hazards except certain hazards of living next to a jungle area. Poisonous insects and reptiles, and a few wild animals, wild boars. But they don't disturb us if we do not trample or get into their way, you see.
Do you remember any pleasant or unpleasant incidents there, besides those that you have already mentioned?
No, I can't.
Mr. Gay, before we talk about the Japanese surrender, very much earlier you mentioned that before you went back to the school to be a principal, you set up a coffee shop business.
Yeah.
Could you tell us how did you set up that business?
Oh, I was living in a shop house. I was staying in a terrace house. Upstairs a living quarters, downstairs is a shop. It's a shop house type, with only one hall. Huh? And there we sold ice water, ice kacang, and coffee. And there was a refrigerator. I used to go to Johor to bring pork out to sell. And that was done when the Japanese came, when the school was just going to be started, when we started to go around to collect the benches and chairs. Even when the school started, my wife did continue for some time. But that was about all. And we, of course, closed. There was no point because no point continuing. We will be earning Japanese money and so on. So, no point continuing. And I was going to move to another place anyway.
Where were you staying at that time?
Near the school, Kun Seng Road.
Why did you decide to set up the coffee shop business?
Because the school was closed and there was no income. I mean, just surrendered already. From whom would we get our salary? So we had to live on something. So my wife said, why not do something and earn some money? The other people were doing the same. Everybody was doing the same. And there was black market going on and so forth.
What were the things that you sell, that you were selling in the shop?
That's about all that the people came along, and sometimes you would go downtown to buy odd things, even gramophone needles, odd things, just anything to grab hold of, because inflation was very fast. You buy things today for $5, and the very next day you can sell for $10. I mean, it was absurd. The most ridiculous that money was worthless, but things, any object that seemed to be useless, could be changed to could appreciate much better than money.
What were you selling in your coffee shop? You mentioned coffee. What else?
Ice kacang and pork, jelly, all whatever that could be got and be put in the refrigerator. That was about all.
All edibles?
Edibles.
Where would you get all these?
From the shops around, there were still a lot of stocks. So whatever we could get, we just went down and we went down to Sungai Road and all those places to buy some of the tin food stuff like lychee and all these things, you see. And when the stocks were running low and so on, we just said no use carrying on. And it was difficult to go to Johor and so to get pork. And the Malays, when they discovered that they had a fridge, a pork inside the fridge, they refused to come and drink and touch your ice water.
So initially you could still get sugar and coffee?
Oh yes. But later they became scarce.
At that time, were the prices already fixed by the Japanese?
No fixed price. The prices were, I mean, all fixed by supply and demand.
Did you use British currency to get all this?
I do. Sometimes British currency, sometimes Japanese currency, all mix up. Really, very silly in wasting a lot of British currency in those days in the beginning, you know. Much to our regret. But it had to be done, otherwise nobody would sell you anything, you see.
How did you sell your meat? Did you cook it or did you sell it?
Raw. You didn't cook anything.
Why did you decide to sell meat?
Well, because we had a friend in Johor who had a pig farm, right? And he said, "You want to get we give you pigs that cheap, you see?" And we said yes. And so we went out and told him he bought one of the two pigs down in the boot of his car, smuggled the thing down, and we brought the thing down there. And we had to cut the pigs into portion and put into the fridge. And when the Malays discovered that, our drink business also went bankrupt. Otherwise, we were doing quite well, I think.
You went up personally to Johor to get the meat?
Yes, I went up in Kulai, I think.
How did you go up to Kulai? How did you go up to
Kulai? He came down in his car and then and we went up with him.
How would you come back?
Came back with him in his car. Came back one trip and later I think he brought the thing down twice or three times or so. A week once.
All in all about three times.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to get permission from the Japanese to go up to Kulai?
No. But if I accompanied him, I had a ban saying I was a teacher. I don't know what was written. What was written there. Obviously, somebody said you written on my ban was Kocho Sensei, principal. On the ban, mean principal. I didn't know any Japanese. Kocho Sensei, principal.
So you mean at that time when you went up to Johor to get the meat, you were already the principal of the school?
Must be, yeah, because they gave me a ban. Okay, so that I had the authority to get all the chairs back.
Before you had the ban, did you ever make the trip to Johor? Before you get the ban, did you ever make any trip to Johor to get the meat?
No.
Only after you?
No. When I got the ban, I did not go anywhere.
It's only when you got
the
ban?
No, people said that it's only you have a ban or pass that you could actually easily go in. You can go in, but you might find difficulty, you see.
So it's only when you had the ban that you decided to make the trips to Johor?
Yes, when I went in, I did not know what my friend was going to do, you see. And he asked me, "You come in Johor, I've got something you can bring out to sell." At that time, Malaysia was occupied, Singapore was occupied by the Japanese. nobody was in authority properly at that time.
When you travel by the causeway, did the Japanese stop the car?
No, the moment they saw me, they bow down. The lower you bow, the better. Stand and bow.
They let the car pass when they saw your bed?
Yes, and you bow. You must come out of the car and bow. You must not sit in the car. You must come out of the car and stand simply and bow respectfully to the sentry. Otherwise, you get into serious trouble.
Were there a lot of sentries at the causeway?
No. Usually, one sentry there. But they are the very important figures. When you see them, you must bow.
One sentry at each end of the causeway?
I think so.
Did your friend have any trouble owning the car?
He obviously had some kind of pass. Because all things being pasted around his car, I don't know what. See, these Johor people and so on, they were under Japanese for some time before Singapore fell, you see. So they had some connection, relationship with the Japanese already, in some form or other.
How was your business? Did it help you during the first few months of the Japanese occupation?
I mean, it was good, of course. It was good. Doing business, when the business is good, even small business could bring in enough. Yes. Oh yes, my wife also made Indian rojak. Indian rojak, you know? Indian rojak, I forgot.
Oh, okay. Why did your wife decide to stop the business later?
As I said, you bring in pork, nobody wants to come and eat it. And it was too difficult, and she had to go back to teach also. She was a teacher. I think she went back to teach also.
When you were doing the business, did you have to get a license from the Japanese to open your shop?
Oh, no. In the early days, actually. I mean, those were the early days.
Who were your customers?
I mean, the people in your neighborhood. There were very few shops open, and people pass by up and down, they would stop.
Do you remember any pleasant or unpleasant incidents when you were doing this business?
No. It was very pleasant to have a business, especially quite a number of people know you, know what you're doing and so on, know that you're a teacher, come from a good family and so on.
What were the hours for your
shop? No, the moment this morning you just open, and when the food is ready, you just put. People see the food ready, they buy. When there's no food, you just pass by. Just no special hours.
Mr. Gate, while you were in Endow, did you know of the declining Japanese war efforts?
Declining? Oh, yes. Occasionally, we did hear of news trickling in that the Japanese had lost in the Battle of Coral Sea, midway sea battle, they had lost, and that the final blow was the atomic bomb, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and you knew that the end was near. Of course, we dared not mention anything. Because at that time, knowing that the end was near, we didn't want to make a mess of things by getting caught right at the last moment.